Who's got the script?
Script? Script?
Where's the show notes, man? Jack, where's the show notes, man?
I've nearly finished writing them. You'll have your copies by first class post.
Good evening, everybody, and you're listening to another episode of At Random. My name is John Wordsworth.
And my name's Rick Timmis.
I'm still Jackson Matthews, I'm afraid.
Are you a Virgo?
Am I Virgo? What?
Are you a Virgo?
It's a very personal question. I'm not gonna answer it on the podcast, thank you.
I can't remember. Or did you say it was a Sagittarius?
I'm a Sagittarius.
Yeah, a Sagittarius.
To be serious.
A proper manly sign. I'm a Pisces, by the way. So.
I'm a Gemini. Oh. Yeah.
So we've got some pretty exciting stuff lined up to talk about today. It's all very future today, isn't it? Talking about Windows 8.
Yeah, well, there's a lot going on. I mean, they say the future's bright, the future's orange, but I think the future's in the cloud by the looks of things.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good prediction, and a lot of the stuff we talk about today is going to overlap with that, isn't it?
It is, absolutely. But John, we were talking just before we got started about this Windows and Microsoft and what they're doing, which looks pretty cool. So, do you want to kick off?
Yeah, definitely. So, we're actually talking about Windows 8 because Stuart left us a note from the last show saying things are starting to heat up on the Windows 8 front. So, thanks for the tip there, Stu. And I think it's gone around the internet pretty virally by now. But in case you haven't seen it, there's a video on YouTube of one of the guys giving kind of a first look of the Windows 8 operating system. It looks very much like a tablet operating system from the video. I think that's fair to say from what we've seen. And any of you who've got a Windows phone, one of the Windows 7 phones, where you've got all these kind of big square user interface elements, they seem to be pushing that really hard with the new Windows 8 look and feel. So.
Yeah, it was all very colourful, wasn't it? Like again, it was like interacting with a magazine, wasn't it? Lots of big blocky cutouts and photos. I mean, obviously they've used the content specifically to show it off to its fullest effect. But that was the kind of look they were going for, like big surface areas to touch with your greasy fingers.
The transitions between each shot, as you on the video, show many things being done with a finger.
Yeah.
You know, and that, yeah, as you say, I mean, the video has that magazine-y feel to it, as does the interface with these little like square sort of sections of a magazine. But it's definitely all being finger-driven. And they even go to the point of saying, but of course you can use a mouse and a keyboard as well if you want to. So, yeah, it's
really
definitely tablet, a tablet OS.
Yeah, it looks, it really does look like the Windows 7 OS running on a 1080p TV screen. From the video, you know, it's all really crisp and it moves very smoothly, but it does still look like the phone OS.
Yeah, but it is very shiny. I mean, on the video, it does look very impressive. And I think, you know, the bar overall, the kind of user interface bar over the last 12 months have been raised dramatically with the tablet PCs, the iPads, and obviously what's happened with the smartphone market. And we talked on the last show, didn't we, about the ARM processor and how that is delivering so much more power in a little area. And of course you can do all of this kind of fancy graphic stuff, and it's got all of that. You know, that's most definitely there.
I think some of the key facts which I kind of extracted from the video, it looked like this was an operating system that was intended to run on both tablets and desktop PCs without any modifications. So unlike the route where Apple have gone, where they've made iOS a separate OS but based on the OS X core, Windows have definitively kind of gone, we're going to make one, it's going to run on tablets and PCs.
Yeah, I mean, the point that concerns me about this is where you say, you talked about iOS runs on the OS X core. I bet you Windows 8 still runs on the Microsoft Windows core, which probably goes back to Windows 3. I mean, I wonder whether you can still get progman.exe to run on it, which, you know, lovely. And they've been doing this a lot recently. They did it with Windows 7, they did it with Vista, with the Aero design, and looking at what they're doing, don't want to slate them off, but Microsoft, you really do need to wake up and smell the coffee and start approaching this differently. You can't just keep repainting the house and telling everybody that it's new. Yes, we've got a nice new interface and, you know, it's all getting that tablet feel, and of course they have to keep up, but I have misgivings about the software application stack and set that they've got, and that working with a finger-driven tablet touch-based UI. I think there are going to be issues with that. But more importantly, we've still got Windows at the core, which has got all kinds of glitches and holes and security vulnerabilities and just loads and loads of general issues. And it is really high time that Microsoft took a lesson from Apple's book and just rewrote the core. Start with a new core again and then give us a fancy interface over the top, instead of trying to just, you know, build on top of this legacy code. They've got the money to do it. They, you know, they've got the cash there in the bank to put the R&D and the investment in place. Do themselves a favour. Let's see a brand new ground up Windows operating system.
The thing is, will they get away with it though, do you think? I mean, obviously we know here sitting that all the stuff at the centre needs an overhaul. But with all this visual clout going on, from a business perspective, will it hurt them significantly, do you think, if they still have the same skeleton running on long at all?
I think it already has. I mean, if you look at when Apple moved from OS 9 to OS X, OS X was a complete rewrite from the ground up, starting with a new microkernel structure, much of it based on Unix BSD technology. Apple at the time had lost enormous market share to Microsoft. In fact, I remember when the early Macintoshes came out and they were just the business. Mm. And that was before Windows released on PC. Lots of water under the bridge. Apple became the small runner. Look at the share price now. Mm. Apple is the most valuable company in the world. Now, okay, yes, a lot's to do with mobile devices, but look at sales of Macs now. They're going through the roof. People are buying them left, right and centre. The UI experience is beautiful. The user interfaces are beautiful. All of those things Microsoft can compete with. But Mac is still, its fundamental core is just so much better. Microsoft are now, they're fighting back off this legacy core. And if they really want to compete at that level with what Apple are doing, and Google are coming with some stuff next, and Microsoft are going to get shoved out of the market space unless they deal with this issue.
I mean, this is treading water, isn't it? What they're doing here.
I really do think so, Jack. I agree.
I mean, effectively, as you say, I mean, they can more than compete with them on a visual level. In fact, they can, like, they've carved out a niche for themselves as, like, with their own distinct visual style, really.
Mm.
But as you say, with all these other operating systems coming out of the woodwork, they won't be able to do it forever.
No. I must sort of strongly confess, while it looks flashy, I've got this horrible feeling that Windows has a bit of a habit of kind of oscillating good, bad, and in my books, Windows 7 was pretty good.
Oh yeah, that's right, yeah.
I've got this horrible feeling that while the videos they're showing us are gorgeous, I bet a pretty penny that they're actually HTML5 widgets running on JavaScript on top of IE, which typically, bit of a rocky road, so I bet you're not going to... But you're going to get some JavaScript errors, let's just say. The core Windows ones will be fine, but when you start adding widgets from other providers, JavaScript errors and empty spaces will pop up, and hazard a guess that I'll be disabling that.
And straight away. John, I completely agree with you, and I think that what will happen is that the moment that happens, those are another whole gamut set of opportunities for the malware, script kiddies, the security vulnerabilities, and they will be in and then taking over the back of that operating system again, and out will begin another lot of botnets and all the kinds of problems and the reliability issues that people see. And still, once again, you know, if you look at the reputation that Apple has now got for its reliability on Mac, it is second to none. Windows has got this dreadful reputation for being incredibly poor. Linux, which is getting stronger and stronger in the marketplace with Ubuntu bringing to the fore, and again, hugely strong reputation about stability. And Google come into the marketplace now with its offerings, which again are stable. They've all got security, stability, functionality, and beauty. Microsoft is trying at the moment to just compete with beauty, and it's still got this horrible, horrible core which is leaving it behind in those other four quadrants. And I think it's too much of a deal breaker for them. I think they are going to kill themselves if they don't get down to the tech department and rewrite this thing.
I think there's one other problem as well that I've found with Windows products. And I've only really been aware that this isn't a problem on Apple when I got an email earlier today. And obviously Windows 8 is around the corner. But I know it's going to hit the marketplace. They're going to tell me that I need it because they're going to cripple Windows, all the other previous versions, by saying, ho ho ho, Windows Internet Explorer will only work on Windows 8 because... no reason, we just want you to buy it. And yeah, they'll probably do a similar thing with DirectX, which completely failed on Vista, where they went, oh, by the way, DirectX 10 only works on Vista, so all you gamers better get upgrading. And all the game developers just kept going with DirectX 9 because no one wanted Vista.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the problem is they charge £100. Now, the new... If I talk to Apple owners, granted it's a smaller set of people, but... the Windows problem, if I talk to someone who's got a Windows PC and they say, oh, I'm having a problem with this, I say, what version are you running? It could be anything from XP, Vista to 7. They're all active now, which means Microsoft has to focus on keeping all three of them working and stable, because it's too much to upgrade. If you've only paid £400 for your PC, £100 to upgrade from XP to Windows 7, you might as well wait till you buy your next computer.
Yeah.
However, with Apple, the... cost of the operating system for Lion is going to be £21.
Mm.
Now, everyone will just buy it.
Yeah, of course you will.
And you've only got to support, boom.
They give you this massive list of features and tell you it's £20. So everyone buys it. Apple probably makes almost as much money. I think what they're doing with the new operating system, the Lion, this is 98% correct, I think, probably. They're actually stopping the server edition of the OS, packaging it all into the main OS and selling it for $20.
Yeah.
So with the $20 OS, you can set up a mail server, a web server, an intranet wiki server, a calendar server, all the stuff you'd pay hundreds of pounds for from Microsoft.
Yeah.
And you can do it with a very simple interface on your home network. £20.
Yeah, exactly.
And everyone will just buy it, and then everyone's using it. So Apple don't have to worry about fragmenting the user base and supporting different versions. When it's £20, it's okay for you to say, that won't work with the old one, you have to buy a new one. When it's £100, that's not acceptable.
No, it's not. And I think, like I say, I mean, I think that they are just, they're just overreaching themselves, and they are overextending the life of the Microsoft, of the Windows code base. Mm. And... you know, I did, on one of these shows, I talked about it a little while ago when I loaded Ubuntu 10.10, and I did a comparison between Windows 7, Ubuntu 10.10 and Apple, and I wrote a blog about it and did some other bits and pieces about that as well. And I said then, at the time, that Windows was coming a firmly second. You know, Apple were at the top. Ubuntu, I believed, was a user experience was better than Windows, and Windows was at the bottom. If you look at Ubuntu's latest release, which is 11.04, which is now using the Unity interface, and again, that interface combines desktop functionality and tablet PC functionality. So you've got these like sequence of boxes down the left-hand side, and you can just flick them to bring up the applications that you want. And just like you would on OS X, you can just tap the corner of the screen and it'll just zoom everything out, put everything out into boxes. It's got a whole load of beauty going on there with it. It's got all of these applications built into it, and they're all free, and you just load it onto your PC and off you go. So, you know, when you're up against those kinds of products that you can get free, you know, Ubuntu.com, off you go, download the CD and put it in your machine, and you're getting that level of offering, Microsoft really have got to raise their game. It's, sorry, but from what I'm seeing, it's not going to be good enough. I think they're making a mistake.
Final thoughts on Windows 8?
I think it's going to be an in-off just like in eight ball pool, I think it's going to be white ball in the pocket, two shots to the opposition.
Jackson?
I think it looks new and scary. I'm not sure I like it.
I concur. I think it'll be fun to play with, but I very quickly will be turning off the new layer and just going back to Windows 7 with probably a few shiny but pointless upgrades.
Yeah.
Well, I just simply am not going to install it because it's a security nightmare.
Anyway, that takes us on nicely, I think, to the next topic of the Google Chromebooks, which I believe you've been looking into, Rick.
Yeah, okay. So, well, I started to hear some announcements about this when I was looking at the recent Google I.O. conference. Mm-hmm. They were starting to talk about a bunch of things that they were doing. And there's been lots of talk about Google's Chrome OS, which is Linux-based, and they've been doing lots and lots of work with that, and they've been working with the open source community developing the Chrome browser, which has been called with Chromium. And now what they're doing with this is they've brought everything together into the browser, and the development that they have put into Google's Chrome browser is unbelievable. It's now something like release 10 or 11, and it's been doing full point releases almost every 6 weeks. Later this month, June the 15th, they are launching into the market space two laptops that are running the Google Chrome OS. One's being manufactured by Samsung and one's being manufactured by Acer. And essentially, the whole operating system is built inside the Chrome browser. And everything that you work with on that device is all effectively being backwards and forwards to Google's server. So everything is in the cloud. It's just like a window to the cloud. And it's like a blend between the kind of Apple App Store and websites, all kind of mixed together, running through the Google Chrome browser. But some of the functionality that is there, that's been built into it, is really cool. Like, for example, Angry Birds, which you can get on, you know, most of your mobile devices and has been really popular, that runs on Chromebooks in the browser, and it is just awesome.
Yeah, you know, I had a play with that recently when the Chrome App Store was released.
Yeah, and there's, you know, a whole new market space there with all of these different apps in it that do different things, and of course you've got all of your Google Docs stuff, so Gmail and everything else is all there as well. The really, really interesting thing about this is the way that it's being put to the market. You don't buy these things at PC World for $299. You can order them from Amazon or wherever it is, and you just pay for them $28. So at the moment in the US, they're $28 a month. That's what you pay for. And Google are going to update it, keep it all looked after, support it. If your device breaks down, chuck it in the bin. They send you another one. Whenever the hardware life cycle goes end of life, they just ship you another one, and off you go. And you just like a mobile phone contract, you just pay them your money, and $28 a month, and you've got the full gamut. Off you go.
Can you ever finish paying for it, or is it just an ongoing?
No, it's just an ongoing payment. Oh, okay. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what happens when the device goes end of life at the end of 3 years. Yeah. I mean, I know the devices themselves haven't got any hard drives on them. It's all just a little bit of flash memory. Mm. The devices have got 3G and Wi-Fi built in, built into them, and I think you can just shove whatever provider SIM card you want in there. Other than that, the device itself is pretty simple, you know, webcam, USB ports, no hard drives or anything like that. So hence you're getting, well, they're quoting 8.5 hours battery life on the Samsung one, which I think is really cool.
But no hard drive because everything is supposed to be on the cloud, yeah?
It is, exactly that. So
it's spooky.
Yeah, well, it is a bit kind of like, you know, but I guess, why not? You know, the network infrastructure is there now. If you think back 10 years ago when you think about going to an old ATA disk drive and saving data onto that disk drive to an old, you know, 10 megabyte disk drive or something like that, the actual bandwidth across the data bus to put the data onto that disk was probably slower or about the same as what we're achieving now over a Wi-Fi network at 54 megs. So in actual fact, yeah, it is spooky and odd that it's like, it's there, ethereal, isn't it? Floating up there somewhere on Google's servers.
Yeah.
But by the same score, there's a huge amount of convenience to that, isn't there?
Yes.
Because, you know,
absolutely.
With your device or not with your device, log in to a browser, into the Chrome interface, log in, and there's everything there on your mobile devices. Wherever you go, wherever you move, it's just there. Your data is wherever you need it. I think that's got a lot of potential.
I've got two reservations. Well, I guess one reservation and one counter argument. My reservation is, while you say the network infrastructure is there, I've tried using my iPad 3G on a train and been very disappointed at how many minutes I've been able to use it out of my 4-hour journey.
Yeah.
It's usually around 20 minutes in a 4-hour journey I actually get to be on the internet, and the rest of it is dead.
Yeah.
Now, if you're relying on that to do work on your laptop on the way to a meeting in London, that ain't going to last very long.
No.
I think my other counter-argument is just that I personally think we're almost hitting this kind of limit of the heyday of the browser. And I think we're going to start going back to having lots of individual apps written on simple frameworks like .NET and Cocoa and even like the iOS framework, where you've got something where, we'll talk about this a bit later, but it's kind of synonymous to Dropbox, but Apple's iCloud solution, where you essentially have a piece of the cloud and your data stored in the cloud, but you've also got a local copy of everything on your own machine. Because, for instance, I know Dropbox is a wonderful solution for when we're editing text files or even code files or websites, and it's wonderful because it's collaborative. But when I've got 4 gigabytes of photos on there and I want access to them now, you're still talking 2 hours to get access to them.
Yeah, sure.
Whereas if I have a local copy, so if I use Dropbox on a machine that I already use it on, then I can get those files instantly.
Mm.
And changes to those files are synchronized almost subliminally to my device. But then if I go to a friend's house and go, oh, no, it's cool, it's all on the cloud, I'll show you the photos from this event. And now my digital cameras are only going to get better and better, so images are going to always be bigger than the instant transfer rate, I guess, is the thing. And my holiday snaps are, you know, 2.4 gigabytes now. And to show him all of those pictures takes about an hour to download them. No, I'm not going to do that.
Well, I think there's a little bit of a... There are some counters against that. I mean, first of all, the train issue. The problems that trains have with mobile devices and using the 3G network on trains is trains are a Faraday cage, so they just capture all of the radio waves and effectively stop anything coming through. However, I know, because I've got a mate of mine who is actually installing Wi-Fi LAN networks into the trains so that you can just go in and connect. There are a few train companies in the UK that are doing this now, and you just go and basically connect, and they're using technology to hook into the 3G networks outside and deal with that. So the point that I'm making here is that network performance is growing just as rapidly. I mean, O2 and BT have been testing these LTE networks, which run over the mobile masts, a little bit like WiMAX, but more powerful than that. And they're quoting 140 megabits a second, you know, so faster than a standard LAN network. For delivering, and that's delivered over the mobile networks. So I think that there's a little bit of catch-up to play there. And bear in mind that here in the UK as well, we are, you know, although we think we've got reasonable infrastructure, in actual fact, it's pretty shoddy compared to what you get in many other countries. So we do lag behind here a little bit in the UK. So
I still don't think we're quite there yet. I mean, if we look at the 3G connection on my phone, I'm not able to make the assumption that I will have 3G wherever I am, even in Exeter. Now, if I go into Cornwall, I'm lucky if I get edge in most places. So
that's Cornwall by any means.
But anywhere between major cities, and you get the same problem. So even if they upgrade the speed to 140 megabits a second, It's only going to be in London, Manchester, Birmingham, Bristol.
Yes, it is. I mean, but you know, and obviously, you know, but having said that, those are the areas where the greatest level of population is. And for us, yeah, sure, you know, we're here in Devon, isn't it? Whereas we guys our laptops out and then gone work over ours, is it? Well, you know, that's just, sorry, nobody gives a hoot about them farm boys down the road there because, you know, they frankly don't make enough money out of it. And they, when you've got, you know, however many millions of people in London and they're punching out 3G to them, they don't care about us. So same old problem, hence the reason for all the EU objective funding down in Cornwall to actually get them, you know, off, you know, off onto broadband in the first instance.
Get rid of the typewriters.
So yeah, you know, I mean, obviously network infrastructure there is a bit of an issue. I mean, I'm sure that these devices have got onboard flash memory, and I would have thought that, I certainly know that in the Chrome browser OS, it's using HTML5 to be able to do things like file management and interface with the local memory as well as the cloud. And sure, I wouldn't be surprised if they haven't built some kind of little caching mechanisms in there and thought about some of those issues to make sure that when you do flick between one pole or another or have a little bit of network connectivity gets lost, that the thing is still a functional tool. Yeah. We'll have to wait and see judgments out on that until people get their hands on them and see whether they work. But if it does work successfully, I think the $28 a month model is a really great idea. I think people will buy into that.
I think that is the winning point of what they've done here. I'm not convinced with Chrome and Chrome apps taking over from having an operating system. I went to the Chrome app store after it launched. Angry Birds was a great example of how good it can be. And every other app that I installed was a link to a different website. And quite often it's another login page. So you think, ah, oh, I've got the app now, I've logged into Google Chrome Store, I've downloaded and got the app for free, and bought it for free, as it were. It's got the icon on my home screen. When I click on it, it goes straight to the Autodesk website and asks me to log in with another username and password, just so I can access it for free. You know, I don't need to. And I'm just like, well, that's not an app, that's a bookmark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
quite often it then links to a Flash animation, and you think, oh.
Yeah.
I was hoping, with it being the Chrome App Store, it would be going to an HTML5 web app. I thought that was the point.
Yeah.
Instead, it's just a link to someone else's website with a Flash animation in it. It's like, well, I could have done that in my bookmark manager.
Mm.
You know, I didn't need to go through this process of buying it. So, you know, I just think, I'm not saying it's not got a place, but I don't think it's going to sweep the market and knock out the need for Macs with desktop applications and things.
No, and I mean, it's probably, you know, a discussion for another show, but the Google, you know, the Chrome App Store, it's a bit too much of a free-for-all and a free-for-all foray. Yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, it's almost like, you know, kind of, it's a little bit, you know.
Sorry, just showing you the something we'll talk about later with the,
Right.
iOS 5. But yeah, so final word on the on the Google Chromebooks. Jack, what do you...
I'm not 100% about this cloud thing. I mean, the more you said about like lack of reception, the more I thought how, like, if you were in one of these places that didn't have it, you couldn't get to any of your stuff because you don't have a hard drive. So none of it's there with you at any one time. I can only imagine that would be restrictive. It's a bit too restrictive by the sound of it. Unless you spend all your time in the city. Unless they start sending out carrier pigeons with SD cards taped to their heads in the event of an emergency, I don't know.
For me, well, I really like the idea of it, and I really want to try one of these things out, but I am going to be hung, drawn and quartered by my wife if I spend any more money on tech. You know, I've got an iPhone 4, I've got a ViewSonic ViewPad, I've got, you know, a Commodore Vic Pro on order, and, you know, if I go out and buy one of these, I will be divorced. So, love it. I think it's a great idea. But if one of you two guys could see your way to getting one, because I can't, sadly, and then we can do a review.
Love it. I mean, I think, I think I made my opinions clear, but I think the real gold here is the subscription model. And, I mean, it would definitely appeal to me if, say, Apple were to do that with their MacBook Pros. Even if the number was much bigger, I think I'd feel much more comfortable going, well, that's fine, it's going to be £45 a month to own one of these things, as opposed to having to cough up £1,700 to start with. Even though in the long run, I'm going to pay more.
But when do you own it? That's the question. When do you own one of these things?
I guess you... I mean, in my perfect situation, it would be after the 3 years or something. Mm. So you've basically paid... You basically got it on hire purchase, I guess.
There are companies that do that. I mean, Apple don't do it directly, but I've seen adverts where you can get an iMac, 27-inch iMac, for about, what is it, about £2.50 a day or something. So that'd be about 100 quid a month or something. And you that's a 3-year lease, and then keep it. You can pay 50 quid at the end of it and keep it.
Those but what I think the other half of the poll, though, is if you're paying that money to Apple, you've got the confidence that when it breaks after a year, you can just walk up to the Apple store and go, it's broken.
Yeah.
And they'll either give you a new one or fix it.
Yeah.
And that would be another pull. Whereas at the moment, after you play the game, do I get the 3-year warranty game, or do I just stick with the year? Because it all just came as a package, and you even got iCloud or whatever they want to give you with it, all as part of this package. Then when the new OS comes out, you just get the upgrade because you're paying the subscription. Quite a nice model.
Yeah, it is. I think you've got a lot to be said for knowing the costs there. Certainly, I know businesses are looking at that more and more and more because they can account into their books and budget on a fixed cost and know exactly what that is. So, yeah.
Cool.
Okay.
Time to move on to something a bit more lighthearted.
Yeah.
Some apps of the week.
More lighthearted? More lighthearted than that?
Well. So, who wants to kick off?
Oh, I'll start off with this little beauty of an app I've found, if I can just get my phone to behave. Let's see now. I'm going to be looking at an app called Stupidness 2. I assume there's a Stupidness 1, or maybe not. Maybe that's part of the joke. basically, this app is all about, I suppose you have to call them visual riddles. Basically, it's a series of pictures that they show to you with a question attached to each one. And it will give you instructions on how to pass the question for each. If I just tap play, nice cartoony graphics. Some of them got a timer at the top to make you nice and panicked. Start off with simple ones. Tap the red circle 3 times. There's a red circle, so I tap it 3 times. And I'm on to the next question. Fair enough. Now we have numbers 26 and 38. Which number is bigger? You say, oh yeah, 38. It says no, because the number 26 is actually drawn bigger.
Right.
And this gives you an idea of what to expect. Now we've got a microwave, a kettle, and a candle, which is hotter. You think, oh, kettle and a microwave. No, it's the candle, because it's got a flame coming out of the top.
Yeah, okay.
And it carries on like this, balloons from left to right. And that, you're popping them, and then another one appears on the left after you've started. They start getting more and more cunning. And ones later on, they get very crafty, like using, in this case of the iPhone, they actually use the facilities of the iPhone to try and trick you. Some of them make use of the accelerometer, like take a picture of an animal, like take a picture of the monkey, but you've seen a picture of an owl and you're not sure what to do. But if you tilt your iPhone in another direction, you can see the monkey because he's like he's off to the side. It's all kinds of clever stuff like that, and they get more and more tricksy as it goes on. This is just the a light version, which gives you like a small series of questions, but you will want more, and the full app is pretty cheap. It's only 59p, but there's a free version if you want to get a feel for whether this is the kind of thing you like. But you do find yourself baited.
Yeah, okay.
there's options to view solutions, but you don't want to do that. Nobody wants to do that.
Yeah, that looks... I can see where that's... I've got a very simple... An element of entertainment about it, hasn't it? That is just kind of, you could just sit down in between, waiting for something to happen or whatever it might be doing, sitting on a bus or something like that, and you could flick through that and just, it's kind of got a little bit of a giggle element to it. Absolutely. As well.
It's the kind of app you show to other people around you and say, hey, look at this, and then other people they'll sit there with it and play it through to the end, and then they'll hand it to somebody else, that kind of thing. But it's just you feel smart. Like when you, because it gives you an IQ rating that's like wildly inaccurate. But
I mean, is that because it got you?
Well,
after over 100, eh, Jack? Well,
but I ended up with something like 200 by the third or fourth attempt. But that's because the questions are always the same. But yeah, lots of fun, and it's some of it is very, very clever.
And what was that called again?
That was called Stupidness 2. But there's a light version for free and a full-priced version for 59p.
Fantastic.
Awesome.
What have you got this week, Rick?
Okay, I've got this running on the iPad. I assume it runs for the iPhone 2, or rather the iPhone 4. Or should I say, I assume it runs for the iPhone also. That's probably the best way to describe it, isn't it? But it's a little app called TradePub. Now, basically what it has is loads of short booklets and white papers on all kinds of different topics that you can imagine. So just to read a few out here, better patient care virtually there. So a little white paper on healthcare. How to efficiently manage your electronic files with document management software. So creating a smarter storage array, so how to set up RAID controllers, or load balancing firewall sandwiches, it says. Load balancing 101 firewall sandwiches.
It's a good name for
very interesting. So, and there are literally just a massive library full of stuff. Best practices for access certification, optimizing total compensation, and all kinds of things on all sorts of different topics. The app is free. You have to register with your email address and your zip code, which is interesting. So zip code or postcode. So they're obviously going to be using that data some way, location and email. But in return for that, you get access to these white papers and documents free of charge. And you can just download whatever you want. And it allows you to open them inside of the app, or you can load them into your iBooks library, which is what I prefer to do. So I pull them down and load them into iBooks, and then you can just have a flick through them. So if I pull one down here, for example, and have a look at something that might interest me. So here, hosted CRM system comparison guide. So if I just hit download on that, it just goes away and downloads that and says you can open in the app itself or make some choices or open in iBooks. I always like to open in iBooks because then I get to keep these PDFs on the shelf and I can look at them ad infinitum whenever I like. And so then it just pops that open, and then here is a nice little comparison table. And it's telling me about, you know, a few different things. And then, you know, there's probably half a dozen or so pages to this that's comparing different things about CRM, tells me about what the prices are with Insider Sales, Infusionsoft, Applicor, SAP, and so on and so forth. So if I'm interested in this or that kind of thing, I've got those PDFs. And so really just access to some just kind of like free, interesting reading material. And as I say, you know, the app is just called TradePub. If you just search for that in the App Store, you'll find it. It's free. Only need to register with an email address, and there are literally, as you can see here, thousands of white papers in there. I think there's something like 5,000 different white papers that you can get access to.
And they're not all computery, techy ones?
No. I mean, obviously, there was one there on healthcare, for example. There's one here about online brand protection strategies. So if you're, you know, they are kind of enterprisey, business-orientated. So we haven't got things like, you know, 20 chef's tips on cheese sandwich making or crocheting monthly or anything like that kind of stuff. But, you know, they tend to be, I think what they've been doing is they've been probably gathering, you know, there's been this penchant for corporates to write free white papers that they then say, subscribe to our newsletter or give us your email address and we'll give you a free white paper. I think what TradePub have done is gone and subscribed to all of these things, got all of these white papers and pulled them all together and then made them available to you. I think that's what they're doing. But, you know, there's lots of different things on here. You know, complete guide to search engine optimization or digital copiers, how to lower your credit card processing fees. You know, just lots and lots of different stuff. And you can, understand it, download the app and have a flick through first of all, because I downloaded the app and it only asked me to register with my details when I wanted to download something. So I didn't have to give any information away just to get the app. I could just stick that on for free and browse through.
Oh, that looks really good. Mm. Not what I got from the name, I must say.
No, the trade pub gives... I'm not quite sure what the connotation would be.
It wasn't that, though. But it looks like a very interesting app. And that's free on the App Store.
I thought it was going to sell beer or something.
I thought some social thing, seeing trade and pub in the same sentence.
Okay,
but
yeah.
Obviously, that was an incorrect assumption. So I'm bringing one... Quite interesting for me, considering I'm not typically the person you think going out doing fitness things, but I've been riding my bike quite a bit lately, and well, I was away in Cardiff a week or two ago, and someone pointed me to this app, and it's pretty cool. It's called RunKeeper, and it's free, and it's just a way of tracking where you... It's obviously got run in the title, but it's a way of tracking activities as you do them, such as running, cycling, walking, hiking, or even skiing and snowboarding, if you so wish. So it does it through GPS, so it sits in your pocket, and it keeps a GPS log of everywhere you've been. And you can also, through the app, you can get it to play your iTunes playlist in the background while you're going for a run, jog, or for me, a cycle. And it's got coaching options, so every mile it can give you some encouraging words about your speed, etc. And I kind of turn all that off because I'm a bit of a stat monger myself. I just like to see numbers.
Or does it talk to you?
Yeah. So it all sort of said, you know, you have run 1.6 miles in 10 minutes.
Faster!
I think it's got some kind of coaching mechanisms, and they're fairly simple. But so if you tell it, I'm just starting out, then it will kind of say, run for 2 minutes, and then after 2 minutes it'll say, you should now walk for 2 minutes. Because that's kind of a popular way of getting into running, is to, you know, not just start off by going, I'm going to run 2 miles, but run for 3 minutes, then walk for 2 minutes, and build it up so it's not just a massive shock to your system. But you can see here, I did a cycle last night, in fact, and it's mostly uphill, and I was very much looking forward to the downhill ride home, but when I got outside, my bike tyre was flat, so I think someone had, on the street had been a bit of a... Yeah, so I didn't get to do the fun ride, but you can see here, so this shows you the pace, and you can probably guess where the hills are from where the pace goes right down.
Yeah.
But what's quite cool is it just keeps a complete track of where you've been on your bike, so while it does it over Google Maps, you don't have to follow the roads. So if you ride across fields and things, it doesn't kind of snap it to a road, it just draws a line across the field. But yeah, you can just zoom into the map here and see where I went. So down across Exeter, through Heavytree, right up the big bugger of a hill, Thorn Park Rise.
Right, yeah.
But yeah, it's just quite a cool 8 minutes, 32 seconds to a mile, and about 204 calories, apparently. But yeah, and again, you can see which miles had the hills in by looking up there.
That's pretty cool, though, that.
But yeah, if you're into any sort of jogging, running, cycling, snowboarding, apparently, but even walking, I guess. I mean, I tested it with a walk or two the first time, just because I wanted to test it, and I didn't. I wasn't going to go cycling that day. But yeah, it's just quite cool if you're like into that sort of thing. Where you went? Oh, this is when we walked across Exmouth Beach.
All this kind of stuff's very big at the moment, isn't it? People keeping track of what they're doing and how much, keeping track of their health and fitness. So I can see this sort of thing proving very popular.
But it's completely free. You don't even have to put in an email address and password. But you can, and then it will put all your activities online, so you can share them with your friends and boast about how you did your 10-mile run in however many minutes that you can do that in. And I think you can also make it post to Twitter when you finished a run or something. So, I just went for a run and did X miles in 8 minutes. But yeah, it's just that now I'm getting a bit more into that sort of thing, and I'm a geek. It's pretty cool to see it drawing a map of where I go and get home and see what my pace was. So
yeah.
I'm hoping in a month's time I'll be able to do more miles per minute, well, less minutes per mile, and then I'll be able to look back and go, ha-ha, I'm getting fitter. Of course, well, too many Pizza Hut pizzas, and that might go wrong. But
yeah, well, I think that I can see the value in some ways of sat navs that show you where you're going and tell you how to get there. I do start to get to worry a little bit when you need devices to tell you where you've been. It makes sense in certain circumstances when you're rolling out the clubs at 3 o'clock in the morning or something like that. But you know, I don't know. But I know that our good friend Jerry has been having some interesting times with sat navs just recently as well, hasn't he?
Oh yeah. How is old Jerry?
Well, we've got a message from him actually, so fantastic. So we can play that one if you like.
Tell we'll put that one on now.
Hiya lads, it's Jerry coming back at ya. Yeah, we had a great time, me and Sean and the lads out of Manchester just recently. Yeah, it was top light. But anyway, I wanted to come back at you this week and just tell you about some interesting experiences I've been having with a new Android tablet PC type gadget that we got our hands on. Me and the Mrs. Techie, we got this Android tablet and put the GPS on it. Well, I tell you, you've seen now like it. This woman, she speaks with American accent and she totally mashed my melon. I've seen now like it, honest. We were going down country lanes and all across the roads, battering vehicle up as we were going everywhere. And this thing was telling us turn right and turn left. And we had a terrible time. We got completely lost. We spent about 2 hours going down roads that you could never bother turning back on. Some of the worst country lanes I've ever seen in my life. Totally just twisted me melon, man. In the end, I had to back up and effectively get a map out. And only 500 yards away was the main road. And this flimmin' app device is telling us to go down country lanes, which takes hours, when we could have been on main road. I tell you what, technology, there's a lot to be said for it, but sometimes you just need to get your map out. Anyway, good to see that it's all going well on the show, lads. I'll speak to you soon. Jerry, over and out.
Oh, that Jerry, eh?
Poor Jerry, I don't know if he's quite made for technology. It does seem to get him upset.
He tries, doesn't he? But
keeps giving it a go, though. God bless him.
But yeah, but on the other hand, you know, he sends stuff in about when he's working on NAS storage and stuff like that in the early session that he's sending. So, you know, he obviously knows a bit of something, but I just wonder if he's a bit antiquated, a bit oldie world.
Maybe he was looking at a map first and that was the problem, not the GPS.
Could be.
So on that note, let's get back into right deep proper tech again, shall we?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to kind of build up, I guess, to the pinnacle of tech on our last little slot. But first, I'd like to talk a little bit about this. Kind of leads on from earlier, I guess, with the Chromebooks. But Apple, a couple of days ago, they announced their iCloud service, which is out alongside the kind of announcement of the new iOS 5 for iPad and iPhones.
Yeah.
Now, what's quite interesting is that obviously they're pushing it in a very kind of typically Apple way. It's this big, new, grand feature. But really, it's kind of a hybrid, I guess, between the Mobile Me service, which they've been running for years, and Dropbox, essentially. They've kind of taken two and just merge them together and put an I in front of it.
Genius.
Why didn't they call it iBox?
but at the same time, while that sounded like a bit of a negative, I think it looks like they've already got it right this time. So naturally, I've already installed the betas of iOS 5 on the phone and the pad. And while I haven't yet had a chance to play with the desktop version, if there is one available yet, I'm assuming it might be in the beta version of OS X Lion. But I can already see the value of picking up my iPad, putting in a reminder, a calendar entry, saving something in Pages, picking up my iPhone, and it's already there.
Mm.
So it's kind of, this is the other paradigm that I was sort of talking about, which is similar but different to the Google paradigm of it all living in the cloud. This is kind of, it lives on all your devices and the cloud. So the cloud acts more of a backup and a central location, but at the same time, there's a copy of it on every device where you want there to be a copy before you get there, or as you get there if you turn it on.
But isn't that the same as like the Chromebooks. They're effectively, yes, you've got your Chromebook, but then if you go to a browser and log into your Chrome OS account, it's there as well. And one assumes that, you know, if Google are smart, they might do something with Android as well. But I mean, you know, similar way. Oh, not as refined as what iCloud and iOS do, because when we looked at that earlier and you showed me, it looks very seamless. You know, and it's been done in a really polished way. And I think anybody would accept that Apple just do things in a really polished, nice way, don't they?
I think the biggest difference, I mean, at least from the impression I've got, I might be wrong, is that with Chromebook, you log into your Google account, and then unless it happens to fit on your 16 gigabyte mini SD card which you put in, you're going to have to go to the web to watch your video, to download your music. Whereas the difference with this one is that, assuming that your phone and iPad are, say, always left on, as soon as you put music onto one, it's on the other. So then if you happen to be kicking back in a room without any Wi-Fi at all, you've still got access to your whole video library. In my impression, if you're using your Chromebook and you're on a train,
you need the connectivity.
Yeah, yeah. Like you said, there's probably a certain level of caching, but if you were just kicking back on the train and went, oh yeah, I watched that episode of Red Dwarf that I put on my iPhone last week, it won't be there unless you've got a sufficient connection to stream it.
So does that mean then if you ascend, so let's assume you own an iPad, an iPhone, and you've got Lion installed on your Mac.
Yeah.
You've got three copies of the data.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, data capacity at the moment doesn't seem to be much of an issue, really, that we've got, you know, huge amounts of capacity around. But I just wonder about the network bandwidth usage there, in terms of, you know, if you've got a 4 gigabyte film that's up on the cloud that you watch from any device, like you would over a Netflix account, for example, whereas if you stick a 4 gigabyte film on, all of a sudden that now becomes 12 gigs of traffic immediately because it's just being replicated everywhere.
I assume, now I've been using Dropbox for the last 6 months, and that's actually quite cunning. So that does the same thing, and that makes a duplicate copy of every file that's in there on every device running it. Now, it doesn't duplicate them on the iPhone and the iPad, and I guess in the same way that iCloud won't duplicate everything on the iPad or the iPhone because they simply won't be big enough. You know, if I put 50 gigabytes of videos into my iCloud account, they won't fit on my iPhone.
No.
But I assume it will either intelligently pick all the small files and let you choose which big files you have. But ignore that element for now. But with Dropbox, what's quite cunning, because we use it in the business, so actually there are probably 7 copies of every file that we have floating around somewhere. There's my laptop, the desktop, the work machine, Jack's laptop, the desktop, the work machine, and then Dropbox itself. So that's 7 copies of every PSD and every game file we have.
Mm.
But what Dropbox does is as soon as you copy a file to Dropbox, then it copies it across the LAN first. It's only going to use up your LAN networking, and then it will send one copy across the internet, obviously, to Dropbox, but it will distribute it to the rest of your devices across the LAN. But it'll do that instantly. So when I put it in there, I say instantly, it will start the transfer instantly. But across the local network, quite often I can look around and say, hey Jackson, look at this PSD, and it'll be on his desktop in his folder, ready to sort of search for it and find it straight away.
Yeah.
It's true, you rarely see much in the way of... in fact, you quite take it for granted. So when something does go a little slow, when you're dealing with like a much larger file, like a 50 megabyte PSD or something like that, you're wondering, why can't I see it yet? Because you're used to it happening so quickly with most regular files, even chunky ones like 10, 5 megabytes.
I mean, I must admit, from what I saw, what excited me about it was the idea that you know, you have got, let's say you've got your iPhone, your iPad, and your iMac. So your iMac's your big workstation, you're sitting at your desk, clickety clickety, doing whatever you're doing, updating records, files, and doing bits and pieces. All of a sudden, you know, Ali says to me, come on, we're going to take the kids out to Creeley, which happens all the time.
Yeah.
And I'm in the middle of doing something, And I normally say, oh, it'll just take me an hour or whatever. All of a sudden now I can say, no problem, 5 minutes. Just finish that up, pick up the iPad, gone. Sit down, gets me a coffee at Creeley, open up the iPad, and I'm on it, tapping everything in there. Then I come home and maybe I'm out, perhaps on my motorbike or something, only got my iPhone with me. All my contacts are there. All my reminders are there because you showed me the reminder things and the task syncing. My files that I've been working on are all there. And the fact that that convenience of just whichever device I'm taking with me to suit my needs right now has got all of that on it. I love that whole model. And I think that that whole space, that whole convenience space fits with the lifestyle of everyday consumers. We're all busy trying to fit everything in. So being able to have our devices with us and, you know, I mean, we're geeks, but, you know, if you think about, there are more mobile phones in the country than there are people now. So people are carrying these devices all the time. Then that offers a level of convenience just for the consumer. Obviously, I always look at these things from a business aspect, and with what our company does, I'm always thinking about how do you do something that gives a business more freedom, more convenience, and allows them to reduce cost. And this kind of thing, again, you know, allows you to be, you know, in your office, out at your client's workstation, at a network meeting, at a conference, with whatever device you want, and there's all your information. Again, you know, so, you know, I think that that whole space is good, and again, Apple are going to do a really polished job of it. So it does look really interesting what it's going to do, and I think it makes, for me, it makes the iPad, what I've seen of iOS 5 and iCloud, just makes the iPod another stage again more usable. So I think it's right that Apple should have a bit of a fanfare about it, because I can see there's some real strong benefits there.
I guess another one of the major benefits, which to us doesn't seem that big, but I think it's bigger than certainly I would see it as initially, is the ability now for you to do over the air upgrades and to back up your iPhone, iPad into the iCloud as opposed to on a PC or desktop. So yeah, no
that's
longer.
That's a big deal, isn't it?
Yeah, that's no longer do you have to have a desktop to open one of these devices and be able to use it fully. You can just go into the shop, walk out with an iPad, and then use it in Starbucks every day. And every day when you get into Starbucks, it can back everything up.
Yeah.
Which means then if you lose it the next day when you buy one, you go back to Starbucks and download it all again.
Which is one of the things that, well, the Google Chromebooks were arguing as well, you know, when in the thing they were saying, you know, well, all of a sudden you happen to drop your laptop in the sink, well, you know, you just get another one, switch it on, and there it all is. And there's a lot to be said for that. And I mean, in a business setting, again, I tend to think about things from that point of view. I can tell you that it doesn't matter how hard you try to tell businesses that they need to back up their data and keep everything secure, they just don't.
Yeah.
They don't. And they're always running into these kinds of problems. Those kind of systems that do that kind of stuff take that problem away and take it out of the business's hands. And there's a lot to be said for that as well. Interesting stuff. Any idea when it's going to be released? Obviously, iOS 5 is in beta right now. What do we think the timeline is for getting it out there onto these devices?
I wasn't watching the keynotes or whatever yesterday. So this is a little bit of a guess, but I think we're looking at fall of this year. And I suspect they're going to hit the market with Lion and iOS 5 and probably a new iPhone all around the same time.
Okay.
So I suspect we're looking at, 3 to 4 months?
Right.
Which usually fits the kind of beta testing period that most of the things go up. I tell you, while it's looking good, it's still very hokey at the moment. as all software is on the first public beta, you know. But I'm very much looking forward in a couple of weeks to getting one that doesn't crash so much.
Always nice.
Well, content editable div tags. That's all I'm going to say.
That's pretty
smile.
Much the dream, isn't it?
It has been for me from the first time I got the iPad. I've been talking about that and saying, fix that, and I've got a usable device. I've got a usable device with that. So that's really good.
There are a couple of other little things I'll briefly gloss over before we move on. But they've reworked the notifications type settings. So now you can get notifications straight on your lock screen, but also with a quick downward swipe from the top of the screen, you can see all your unread emails and calendar invites, which is pretty cool. It's just a convenience thing, but it helps to you haven't got to sort of tap through the apps on the bottom in turn, which I'm sure you've probably done in the past. You go, oh, I've got a text message, two calendar notifications. Load up one app, wait for it to load, check your message, then load up the next app, check the invite, load up the next app, and check your email. Now it all just sits there on your home screen, so that's, I think that's a good move. They've added the reminders, like you were saying. That's pretty cool. I worry that it's going to put things, the company things, or the product things out of business. And that's basically a to-do list, which costs a tenner for the iPhone, which has always been the thing that's put me off it. And the Mac client for it's 50 quid, I think. And I'm glad to see it's now going to be kind of essentially free.
Right.
With the device. Safari's got traditional tabs. I guess that's kind of a kickback. Moving slightly more away from the phone-like feel of the iPad. One of the criticisms it received was it's a bit too much like the iPhone. Anything else? Anything else to briefly touch on? Minor mail upgrades. So mail does a few more things that it didn't do before. There was one more thing, but I've forgotten it. Oh, Twitter integration is quite nice. So now the pad itself lets you set up Twitter accounts in the general settings, which I assume means that iOS 5 apps will be able to just use your Twitter details without you having to enter them for every single app you load up.
All those iPad developers that wrote all those Twitter apps must be weeping then.
I think the Twitter apps will still be useful if you just want to browse Twitter and filter and search. But the integration will mean, because at the moment a lot of games will let you tweet your high score. Now every single time you say, yeah, okay, you can tweet my high score, it says, what's your Twitter username and password? And then you go, oh, I can't bother to enter it. Because now the phone will just know it. So when you get your high score, it will say, do you wish to tweet it? As soon as you say yes, it will do it. That is the other major thing, which could be quite a big game changer. Sort of like battling the BlackBerry's back a bit, I guess, is this iMessage, which is the ability for iPhones and iPads to essentially text message each other for free. With photo, video, and contact details all embedded. So I guess it's kind of a hybrid between text messaging and emails.
Okay.
So it's intended for short messages, but I assume it uses something more like emails in the background. But to the user, it's a text message, and it's kind of similar to BlackBerry's messaging service. But the logic is, if you've got an iPhone and your friend's got an iPhone, you can text each other for free.
Okay.
And obviously, I know in my social circles, probably 50% plus of people have iPhones. So that's a fairly big deal in my eyes.
And that's true even for like people in other countries and stuff, yeah?
Yeah.
Even internationally, that's exciting.
Because it would just, again, it's essentially kind of an email under the hood.
Yeah, just a cunning way of sidestepping it by making an email behave like a text.
Yeah, I guess the probably the biggest key is the fact that your phone will buzz and they'll be short. Whereas emails are typically quite long and they go into your inbox and you have to sort of set time aside to read them. But as the interface is all built around the messages being small and text message-like, and because obviously it will come in and make your phone buzz like a text message, so they'll feel like text messages even though it's just sending data across like an email. So.
Okay.
No, it's a big deal.
But yeah, so that's definitely something to, if you're geeky, you probably already have been, but it's worth having a search around the internet. There are links to a couple of pages on the Apple site that explain all the things we've been talking about in more detail. So, and they're on our website.
Yeah.
Cool. Which I think brings us nicely into one more of our fan-led topics.
Yeah, so this was, Andy wrote an email to us at the beginning of the last show. And he talked about PGP and said, could we look at that and explain it in words of, less than two syllables and quite straightforward, and talk about a little bit about PGP, which stands for Pretty Good Privacy, I believe. I've not done as much research as I should have done on this, But I have had experience in the past of using it. But it's based around encryption. Quick summary, John? Any kind of...
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you what I, what my vision of it is in my head. I mean, at its heart, and I think this is one of the problems I'm going to talk a bit about later, is it's a command line tool.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what, in my head, that's what it is. It's a command line tool which you use to... Essentially, it has two main purposes, doesn't it? So one of them is to encrypt your messages and then have it decrypted at the other side using kind of the public-private key matching, which is the secret sort of... Not secret, the secure layer that usually protects your credit card when you're buying something off Amazon. There's that level of encryption, mm-hmm. but with a much higher sort of bit rate so that it's harder to crack. But then the other side of it is the authenticity. So you can provide someone with your key and then they can tell that the message definitely came from you. And those are two actually very powerful tools that still don't really exist in the mainstream email communication at the moment.
No. I think you've summarised that really well in with the idea of what the encryption is and then this creating this circle or web of trust. My experience with it has been sort of twofold, really. I remember it was an add-on extension for the Mozilla or the Netscape suite. So the Mozilla suite was a browser and email client and calendar and a whole bunch of stuff all built together. And you could get this plugin called Enigmail. And what it would do is it would run the PGP command line tools and encrypt your emails, signing it with your public key at the bottom, and then fire them off to people. And of course, people at the other end then could do the unencryption. And of course, if you had exchanged public keys with them, or what, there's some exchange that goes on, then they could indeed authenticate people. And what used to happen then at the open source, these LUG meetings, the Linux user group meetings, is you'd see people, they'd come to the meetings with like these long, almost like an A4 piece of paper cut into a long strip, and printed on it in lines would be this key, right? And then when they met you face to face, you know, like, hello Dave, hi, I'm Michael. Great, nice to meet you, Michael. Michael, this is my PGP key, and if I could have your PGP key. And so now we have a web of trust, a sphere of trust between us. And then I could go away then, and I could say to Jack, hi, Jack, if you could give me your key, and I'll give you my key, and because I know that you're really you, if I can take a second copy of your key, because I know Michael... And this is really Michael's key. So now, even though you've never met Michael, I can introduce you into that sphere of trust. And they used to do this with these little strips of paper and get very excited about it. And I used to think to myself, I like technology and I love this open source stuff a lot, but I'm really feeling quite uncomfortable with this little exercise. So that was kind of my experience of it. I think... I mean, the possibilities of it are great. I mean, legal firms and, you know, I'm surprised the lawyers and the legal firms didn't kind of jump right on it. I wonder where we would be today with anti-spam mechanisms if it had really taken off as with email. You know, that'd be something to talk about, what the possibilities are there. So, yeah, that's kind of my insight. Jack, what do you think of all of that?
I'm just imagining a world without spam. I can really see the application of it now. It's blocking out all this other rubbish. I suppose I think it might be with spam. I suppose like the line gets blurred between that and marketing, doesn't it? Which is why they wouldn't want. I can imagine like a lot of companies not wanting something like that to take too firm a hold because it stops because they want to send emails to people who don't necessarily want the email. You know, they want to get their. They want to get their message to them at any cost. So I think advertisers would probably see it as a bit of a barrier to them getting ahead.
That's a huge hurdle, I think, more so than anything else. Yeah. It's almost a game killer.
It's a pretty, yeah, exactly. Which is probably why it didn't there wasn't enough money in it.
No, yeah. I mean, certainly, you couldn't go to the advertisers, could you, and say, we've got this really cool technology that's going to encrypt everybody's email, yeah. and, you know, we were thinking of funding it, and we could do some advertising for you, and what yeah. it's going to do is stop you advertising. Yeah. You put some cash in.
Coca-Cola giving you a big strip of paper. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I'm the CEO of Coca-Cola, and this is my key. Oh, it'd be mind blowing, wouldn't it, to think of? Ah, yeah. I mean, I think, but legal firms, you know, if you think about, I mean, how long have the legal firms been badgering everybody to put this massive diatribe at the bottom of their email, and then we, well, of course, you know, when I'm not driving my Aston Martin, I can write this for you. A privacy disclaimer that ensures that you're not liable or responsible for any of it, or whatever.
In case it wasn't me using that email address.
Exactly, that's right, yeah. So why didn't they jump onto it? I mean, it would have been, I'd have thought you could make some money out of that, wouldn't you? Saying, look, you know, we can do this, we can write your signature for you, and, in fact, we can offer you this PGP, pretty good privacy and security, which will actually authenticate it. So then in a court of law, you can substantiate that these messages really came from you or didn't come from you. You know, there are some models there, but it just didn't seem to go anywhere.
I think at the crux of it, I think the technology is really good. I think the idea is really good. I don't think there's enough benefit for one of the main players to pick it up. Now, I think for it to take off, it needs to be integrated into something like Outlook, iPhone and iPad. One of the major players, or Gmail, one of the major players needs to pick it up and integrate it into their mail client before it even has a chance to take off.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, preferably a couple of them would do it around the same time. And then it would be something which happens similarly. I think as soon as you say you have to install this plugin, which is your own choice to do, people go, why would I do it? And you can't really sell it to the general population as a reason to do that. Like, oh, all you need to do is you need to type in this 80-character key on this slip of paper, and then you know I emailed you. I'm like, but it's got your name at the bottom.
Exactly, yeah.
Now, but it's possible that someone could fake an email from my account. But again, to Joe Public on the street, you go, why would they do that, and why do I care?
I mean, thinking about a scenario, obviously, if you take the Anna Kournikova virus, when that went round, the I love you note went round to everybody, and the first thing that virus did was just rip everybody's contact details out of your Outlook address book and just mail everybody and tell them all, you know, that it was all you. Would PGP encryption, pretty good privacy, have stopped that?
Well, now, obviously, it comes back down to the clients again, but I think if the clients implemented it well, now obviously you wouldn't want to block out all email that isn't from a trusted source.
Mm.
Otherwise, you'd never get emails from A, someone that isn't using an advanced client,
yeah.
or B, anyone that you don't know.
Mm.
So I think what you'd need to do, but what you could then do, quite trivially, is you could A, prioritise email from trusted people, because you know if they're on your keychain, then it's going to be an email that's more likely to be relevant to you. But B, you could just block images, scripts, attachments from all ones that aren't trusted.
Yeah.
And at that point, that defeats that sort of virus.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, those kinds of features, when it's used subtly like that in the client, that works really, really well. I mean, I can kind of see this vision. I mean, one of the difficulties I have with the, you know, a couple of hundred emails that come into me on any one day is sitting there in the mailbox and just going through them and going, and I'm actually looking at the sender and picking out the critical ones and then identifying those first. Well, that keychain would immediately, I could immediately have almost like inbox keychain, and then I could just go into there and straight away filtered are all the people that are already in my circle of trust, where I know straight away those messages are there, and I don't have to display the images, or I don't have to worry about any of the scripts, or really I don't need to worry too much about any of the attachments. I mean, I think any attachments you need a little bit of care, but you know, pretty much I can be a lot more trusting about those. And of course, it allows me to hone in on the critical things and then deal with the other stuff later. So I think, you know, there's some real, there are a lot of benefits there from that side of things. The key to it is nobody seems to want to pick that technology up, or they want to invent something else. And I mean, we were looking earlier on, and this is a technology that was invented in 1991, you know, and everybody's trying to reinvent the wheel.
I was going to say, do spam filters use any similar technology to that? Do they work in a similar sort of way?
I think they kind of work in the similar but opposite way, don't they? So they have blacklists. So email addresses kind of, if you're in the spam business, I assume there's servers somewhere and that they'll list these email addresses that are bad and they think they're sending spam.
RBLs and XBL lists special blacklisting servers that you can report to, and then you can have your mail servers look up on those lists and then just deny mail if an IP address for a machine is on that list. Yeah, so that's exactly how those blacklisting and greylisting servers work.
But obviously the problem with that technology is that you can make a new email address with a random number generator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you can probably find a proxy or spoof your IP as well.
Mm. Yeah.
So then... Yeah, that's the...
Well, on Gmail, I have next to no spam. I can't even remember the last time I got any spam on it. So, I don't know what they're doing.
They use Spam Assassin.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Spam Assassin, they've modified it themselves. And so Spam Assassin is at the core, which is an open source product. But also, they crowdsource.
Right.
So, you've got a button in Gmail that says, mark as spam, haven't you?
Yeah, sure.
And when you mark something as spam, if enough people mark it as spam, that crowdsource then effectively blacklists that from everybody else. Huh. So there's some crowdsourcing and some spam assassin going on, as well as some blacklisting. The other model is heuristics. Message labs and people like that use a lot of heuristics. The idea of, which in Bayesian calculations, which is what Spam Assassin is doing as well, which is looking at a message and statistically scoring it on the words and things like that, contexts of things that are being written in there, and then trying to guess that it's spam. And it's not really an exacting science. A tool that I've come across, and I'm surprised that it didn't get picked up as well as it should have done, in our company, we use it and provide it to our clients. And the mechanism works by having an internal whitelist and blacklist internal to you. And so what happens is, and you've probably seen these yourself, you send an email to somebody, and if they've not had an email from you before, you automatically get a response back. Yeah. And it says, hey, just send reply to let me know you're real. And then when you send a reply, it pops you on the whitelist and delivers the mail.
Yeah.
And those spam tools are really, really, really good, really accurate. And I see the PGP mechanism operating like that, almost like of, you know, rather than keeping a list of email addresses, what you're actually doing now is keeping these keys as your whitelist and operating it like that. And I think that if that was implemented well, you could almost banish spam completely.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, I think at the heart of it, the problem with getting out to users is that it would need to be picked up by someone like Apple, who just puts it in their client, so it becomes so big that other clients pick it up as well. But the reason that won't happen is because the push to users isn't big enough.
Mm.
Like you said, people want to find other solutions, but also I guess governments probably won't be comfortable with us encrypting mail to each other.
Yeah, there is that as well. I mean, certainly in the States, they have laws outlawing certain levels of encryption to stop you encrypting stuff to that level. So there, you know, PGP, like we say, command line tool. You can find out some information on Wikipedia about it. I don't know whether Firefox still, Thunderbird, as a mail client, still allows you to plug in tools like Enigmail and stuff like that. But certainly it used to, and you could load those plugins into the client. I don't know whether anybody did any for Outlook. Were there any third-party plugins for Outlook to do it?
I haven't looked since the days I used Thunderbird, and that was a long time ago.
Yeah, I had the plugin for Thunderbird and used it. But I never did print any keys out.
He proudly states.
No, didn't do that. Well, there we go. I think another slightly longer show than ever.
Creeping on every time a little bit. You know?
It is. Don't forget to get in touch with us if there are things that you want us to talk about or things that you want us to look at or just generally have a bit of a chit-chat about. Get in touch with us, show@random.org. Send us an email and, of course, make sure you send your address and we'll get you one of those wonderful mouse mats out in the post to you that Abazander has given to us. Another thing I'd like to see, guys, as well, is some sound bites. If people would like to, grab a copy of Audacity and record a little bit of something, send something in, maybe something for Jerry to consider or something to go along with him, then send some sound bites in, some mashups. It'd be great to hear some stuff like that as well.
On the same note, if you're in a band or something, awesome. We're always on the lookout for some outro music as well. Or even something to feature in the bridge in the middle.
We wouldn't mind a theme tune. A theme tune would be really good.
It's something with saxophone, if possible. I don't know if there's any saxophonists out there but who also like PGP. Because that would be quite topical.
And drum and bass. Drum and bass sax intro.
Getting down with it, I love it. And that just about brings us to a close, doesn't it?
It does. I have been, and even after you stop listening to this, I still will be, Rick Timmis. Look forward to talking to you at the next show.
You can keep calling me John Wordsworth, because it's great.
How about Doctor?
Dr. John Wordsworth.
Yeah, call him Doctor, for God's sake. Good night, true believers.